Because of this, we did a briefing about this near landing on the farm in Alton Barnes. When Chris Mansell got up, he said, "There was a bloody spaceship in the field and I was gobsmacked. It was the first time I had ever heard that word, and it was just perfect." By 1993, we had decided to expand these efforts and have a more concerned group of people called the Rapid Mobilization Investigation Team, the RMIT. Had been in the country 6 hours when this happened. The next day we went around the backside of Popo and arrived in the little town of Atlixco, where 90% of the people had seen these objects around the volcano. We sensed that the ETs were there because the ring of fire was going to become more and more unstable, and this was the fourth largest volume canoe in the world, looming outside one of world's most populous cities. We sensed that the extraterrestrial vehicles were there to monitor the situation and take actions to help stabilize the Earth. We found a perfect site near the little Indian village called Atlimyaya. Atlimyaya is at the end of the road past Atlixco and Metepec. The glow from the city of Puebla can be seen from the high plain, at the base of the volcano outside Atlimyaya. Atlimyaya literally is where the road ends. From there, the native people go on trails out into the jungle and the forest at the base of the volcano. Off the road to Atlimyaya we set up our operation with 5 SETI members present. Once I saw the setting, I knew that it was exactly what I had seen in the lucid dream 7 days before. And so I said, "This is exactly where we should be." The moon was up and about 2/3 full. After a period of doing this, 5 contact protocols, I grew very tired and laid down. I settled into a deep meditative state, very relaxed. Then suddenly, I got a clear message that said, "Sit up and look to the right." So I sat up and looked to the right. Coming towards us from the volume canoe was an enormous triangular craft. We all stood and connected to the ship. I could see in my mind's eye the person in charge of the craft and the other beings on the craft. They were all extremely luminous and white. These ETs were very directly connected to us, by way of a device that was on board the craft. They were absolutely locked onto our consciousness, using a mind technology interface device. As always, we were using thought and consciousness as a vectoring tool. To confirm that they were seeing us, we signaled with very bright lights, and then this huge craft signaled back, and turned directly towards us. Then it made an almost perfect circle around us, hovering very low, just a few hundred feet above us. It was the size of about 3 football fields on each side of the triangle with a light at each corner. As it signaled to us, the entire leading edge of it would light up. All of us could sense the extraterrestrial beings, and 3 of the 5 of us saw the same beings and received the same message about why they were here, the volume canoe erupting and what would happen in the future. The craft then went off towards the direction of Puebla. As it left, we were saying good, bye, and I signaled toward the receding edge one more time. Suddenly, the other edge of it that was leaving the area signaled back and said good, bye. It then descended lower than our altitude and disappeared somewhere into a valley. Later that same night, we were sitting in a meditative state, connect in with cosmic beings, at the base of the beautiful snow-capped volcano. As we looked up, we saw that a very unusual oval, shaped ring of clouds had formed to the left of the volcano, that looked exactly like a humanoid face. And the 2 brightest stars in the sky, were exactly centered where there should be eyes. This cosmic face was looking at us from beside the volcano. And there was no question in any of our minds that this was a very unusual signal from these beings saying that they were still with us. On the day of this event, we had been exploring the area on foot. We went on a hike deep into the jungle and found an ancient pyramid covered with plants that, to my knowledge, was not on any map. While we were there, we had a series of very unusual mystical experiences with nature and the volcano. We met some native people who related stories to us about what they had experienced with the extraterrestrial beings in the area. The messages and images they received were nearly identical to ours. As we left the jungle, we looked up and saw in the sky a formation of clouds that made the exact shape of an eagle. and the beak of the eagle was pointing to precisely where our field, work site would be that night. We knew everything was being orchestrated by a higher intelligence, the one mind of the cosmos through which we are all connected. Over the course of those 5 days, we had multiple sightings of these ET craft, including smaller disc-shaped ones that would come straight up out of the volcano, circle the top of it and then fly off into space. All of these accounts have been written up in more detail in my first book. The key to everything that happened is universal awareness and an intent that is good and peaceful. By 1993, it was clear to me that this effort to create contact between humans and extraterrestrial people was attainable. It was no longer a theoretical question. By then, there had been hundreds of people in the United States, Europe, England and Mexico that had been with us on expeditions where contact had been made. Many of these events had been filmed, and all of them had been mass witnessed. So now what? If we have the body politic and the masses of the people of the Earth being lied to about this, how far can we take this? We needed some way of educating larger numbers of people in the world. I knew we must bring out the truth. We needed to provide the evidence and this peaceful perspective to our political leaders, our governmental leaders and the scientific community, and most importantly those running these covert programs. Word of our work was out and I developed a network of military, political and scientific contacts between 1990 and 93. We also learned that there were extremely powerful weapon systems being used to target extraterrestrial spacecraft and destroy them. We learned that rogue, covert projects were running these operations and that this was one of the greatest threats to world peace, ever. But the entire matter was being completely ignored by the media, by the mainstream military community and by the mainstream political community, never mind the man on the street. So at this point I felt it was important to bring together people to try to disclose the evidence and the facts, and explain to the public and our leaders what the meaning is behind the ET presence. I began to articulate this concept of pulling together people to disclose the truth so that it would not be just an ad hoc group of part-time people making contact, but society at large would begin to acknowledge that we are not alone. It was time for the community of civilized people to take responsibility for the relationship between humans and extraterrestrial people in an enlightened and peaceful way. If we didn't do it, no matter how much contact our little group might have, it couldn't begin to correct the problems of a multi-hundred-billion-dollar-per-year shadow government that had enormous technological prowess, reconnaissance abilities and weapons that were being deployed all over the world, and in space. We knew these weapons were attacking ET vehicles and the people on them, and we had multiple independent corroborating military witnesses to this. In the summer of 1993, I was invited by some people to come to a home near the Monroe Institute in Virginia to discuss the initiative to disclose all this information to the world. Some very fine people were there, but later I found there were some people who were there with other agendas. We discussed how to best achieve disclosure and how to reach the larger society. Towards the end of that meeting, I decided to commit to this effort, what is now known as the Disclosure Project. In the early days it was an unnamed initiative and later had a project name given to it called Project Starlight. As I was leaving the area near the Monroe Institute, which is very near where we now live, I was hit by some sort of an electronic weapon system. I suddenly became completely and utterly disoriented, febrile, as if I was on fire from the inside. I became so disoriented while driving my vehicle, that I didn't know if I was back in England, we had been in England earlier in July, or where I was. I didn't know which side of the road I should be on, and in fact I discovered I was on the wrong side of the road. If I had not been able to transcend the power of this weapon, and snap back in and reorient, I am certain I would have been killed in a head-on collision leaving the area of the Monroe Institute. It was very disturbing. I learned from that experience that there are shadowy people watch, in what we are doing very carefully, and that they would do almost anything to try to stop us. But when I'm faced with such a challenge, my reaction is to fight twice as hard. Over the course of the next few months, I talked to people I knew who were in the political and military realm who showed great interest in what we were doing. Many supported the disclosure project. We put together a team of people to create a plan to get this information to our leaders. I began to articulate this agenda to groups, explaining that it was time for the truth to come out. As a result, a large network of support developed. After one of these talks in Colorado, a gentleman, I'll call him MJ, came up to me and said, "I know a few folks in Washington who can help. I'm all ears." I said, "I'm friends with the new CIA director, Jim Woolsey. He used to be on the board of my institute. What you're saying makes sense. And it needs to happen." He said, very sincerely. It turns out, MJ had been one of the people following our work, and had written a book, under contract from the Coast Guard. It was for the military in general, and there was a section of the book on wildcard scenarios of events that could happen in the future, but were not anticipated by the mainstream military. A section of it was about SETI and the CE5 initiative, though it wasn't named, but it described everything we had done, and even included scenarios like a group going out to a beach in Florida, making contact with ETs. I then realized there was another whole orbit of people watching what we were doing. Many of them were futurists and people connected to top national security and intelligence fields who felt that this information should begin to come out. Around that same time, some people in New York who were friends with Lawrence Rockefeller approached me and said, "You know, this is something that Lawrence Rockefeller is very interested in. I'm willing to meet with anyone about this." I said. I ended up having a series of meetings in the summer and fall of 1993, and one of them was with our military advisor for the project, a naval commander, whose father and grandfather had both been deputy directors of NASA and before that NACA. He had been very supportive since 1991, when we first met, and he said that, "You know, I can help you with the military end." Then another man surfaced who was a friend of Bill Clinton who said, "I can help you with the political end." And other people surfaced and said, "Look, we can get this information to the CIA director and to the national security people." And another man surfaced who wanted to get this information to Dr. Jack Gibbons, who was the president's science advisor. Then another man, whose brother was the science advisor to Al Gore, the vice president, helped us. So a whole group of people assembled rather quickly around this time. I was very aware that there could be a number of mixed agendas going on. And at the same time, I was acutely sensitive to the need not to be prejudiced against anyone because of his affiliations. My goal was to simply speak the truth, explain what needed to be done and educate. By this point, there were CIA people surfacing, flying into Asheville where we lived then, saying, "Do it and do it now. We're part of a group that wants to see this happen. It has been kept secret for too long. My largest effort has been associated with providing information and perspective to people who are in clandestine programs or are in what people call the control group or high cabal. Much of what I have written and said has been oriented towards providing information and a new paradigm to those people." In September of 1993, our military advisor had approached the man who at the time was the head of intelligence for the Joint Staff, an admiral. He later became Director of Naval Intelligence, DNI. Our military advisor said to the admiral, "Look, I'm working with Dr. Greer of SETI, and we want to meet with the people at the Foreign Technology Division of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. This is the entity that had received some of the material from the extraterrestrial vehicles retrieved from New Mexico in the 40s. As it turns out, this group has been renamed the National Air Intelligence Center or NAIC. But in 1993 it was called the Foreign Aerospace Science and Technology Center, FASTC. Interesting how they keep changing names." Surprised, this admiral pushed back from the desk and asked, "Are you serious?" "Yes, sir," said Will. And then the admiral asked, "Well, is Dr. Greer serious? Is he credible?" And he said, "Extremely credible, sir." So the admiral said, "All right. I'll set it up." He called Wright, Patterson Air Force Base, and said, "I want you to meet with Drive Greer and his team." But the base commander said, "We won't allow it." Eventually the admiral ordered the head of Air Force Intelligence to make the meeting happen. That same week in September of 1993, I had been invited by Lawrence Rockefeller to his ranch in the Tetons. So first I went out to Lawrence's ranch. As it turns out, a number of people involved with this subject had been invited to the ranch, many who were tied into the intelligence community. In addition, there was one of Rockefeller's chief aides, a wonderful man, who was very supportive of our work. Also there was a woman in red, whom it turned out had been in Lawrence Rockefeller's circle for years. Her husband, I'll call him Bruce, was on the boards of Morgan Stanley and many top transnational companies and was also a CIA operative. He told me this personally. He also had been one of President Reagan's ambassadors. So into this interesting mix arrives this country doctor from North Carolina, who has been making contact with the ETs. At an early meeting, I explained that we were putting together a team of top military insiders and evidence, and intended to disclose the matter to the public. You could have heard a pin drop in the room. They asked, "You're going to do what?" And, "Who are you working with?" And, "What is going on?" I said, "Well, when I leave here I'm going straight to Wright, Patterson Air Force Base. There are covert military and intelligence factions that are supportive of disclosure. I am not speculating on this." I was very forthcoming. "Here's what we're going to do." It was clear people were stunned. It was obvious that there were people at this meeting who were outraged at the prospect of a disclosure. I remember having a conversation in 92 with some of General T.E.'s people who asked, "If you make contact where it's a very large event that gets televised, will you allow us to control it first before it gets out to the public?" "No, I won't," I said. Then they said, "We control the media, and all the satellites they use, so we will take control." To my disappointment, it was confirmed to me again by C.B. Scott Jones that, ultimately, that it would, indeed, be controlled. Yet, I vowed, "We're going to keep this as independent as is humanly possible." The ranch is surrounded by Grand Teton National Park. On the first day we were there, I was on a walk around the lake with two prominent abduction researchers. I'll never forget how one of them, I'll call him Mr. X, proceeded to inform me that he was a big advocate of hallucinogenic drugs, that in fact at that very moment, he was on hallucinogenic drugs. Of course, he was stumbling around the lake, falling over logs, and I knew something was not right. So here is this famous abduction researcher, who told me that his work involved people whom he encouraged to take hallucinogenic drugs to help recall their abduction and sexual experiences with aliens. I thought, oh, my God. So that's how that spin is making its way into the public. Of course, I subsequently learned that Mr. X had deep connections to the MKUltra CIA program dating back to the 1950s and 60s. They were developing mind control with the use of hallucinogenic drugs. There is a complete and utter infiltration of civilian ufology with people who are operatives from covert, shadowy intelligence fields, and who are involved in some of the most bizarre mind control experiments, including high-powered drugs mixed in with electronics and so-called psychotronic weapon systems. The truth is so much stranger than any fiction you will ever read, this conjoint madness to concoct alien encounters, and then rubber stamp them as having actually happened. Now, one of the interesting things that was discussed was how he had been persecuted for doing this abduction research, and that he was some type of victim. In reality, what happened is that not only had he been doing drugs with his subjects, but he had been doing something that is an absolute ethical no-number. He had been billing his research subjects for his time. In a research experiment, you can't charge the subjects. This is highly immoral and unethical. One of the things that I learned in the course of this meeting at the ranch with Lawrence Rockefeller was that David Rockefeller, of Chase Manhattan Bank and Nelson, who had been U.S. Vice President and had passed away, were very much involved in the secret government. Lawrence Rockefeller knew of these things, but he was really more of the philosopher king of the family and was not the power guy. He was a professional philanthropist, who genuinely wanted to just give away his wealth before he died. Unfortunately, he had morally inept people surrounding him, including this nest of CIA people, not the least of which was the woman in red whose husband was CIA. So into this mess steps Lawrence Rockefeller, wanting to support getting information out about this subject. But his mummy is intercepted by CIA operatives and ne'er-do Wells and is funneled away into bogus abduction research, substance abuse, and all kinds of other craziness. One man in Lawrence's circle specifically intercepted what would have been an enormous amount of funding for Xeti to have a CE5 initiative professionally supported, and took it into his own institute, so it could then be funneled back into other clandestine operations. This I know for a personal fact. So Lawrence had some very good intentions, but was surrounded by a circle that was infested with a number of intelligence operatives who were hell-bent on keeping his resources away from productive work. Their task was to open a toilet lid and put millions of dollars in it and then flush it into the sewer. And that is what they did. I witnessed it firsthand, and it was a tragedy of the first order of magnitude. Eventually, Lawrence Rockefeller's whole interest in this area got intercepted by this woman in red, whose ethics were appalling. Around this same time, we had put together a series of documents that constituted what is called the best available evidence. In the spirit of collegiality, I shared this openly as a work in progress with Lawrence and with other people. It turns out that the woman in red intercepted it, took Lawrence Rockefeller's and one of Xeti's stalwart supporters' money and hired a writer within the UFO community. He then took it, rewrote it, put their name on it, copyrighted it and stole it from us. Later, when we tried to use it for further free and open briefings, she hired one of the biggest law firms in Washington and threatened to sue me. How nice. This, after they stole the concept, including the title of the entire document. Notwithstanding these issues, I developed a bond with Lawrence. I had some very lovely times with him and his wonderful wife, Mary. I recall, towards the end of one evening, Lawrence and I walked out onto a wooden deck off from the lodge where we were meeting at his ranch. On this deck was a statue of a Native American on horseback with headdress, arms outstretched to the stars. We were looking up at the sky and talking. Lawrence turned to me, and said, "You realize that no aspect of life on Earth will be unchanged by this matter being disclosed, so profound and far, reaching are the implications." "Yes, Lawrence, that's why it's secret and that's why it has to happen," I said. "But we need your help." "I want to help," he said. "But my family is already jumping up and down on my feet because I'm involved this much." "You still need to do the right thing here," I replied. "It's much too dangerous," he said. "Well, Lawrence, my God, you're old, you're rich, and you're a Rockefeller," he replied, "my hands are tied. But know this, you have to do it. Think of it this way, it's like a flock of geese in a V formation, and you need to be up here at the front breaking new territory, and we will be back here." "Oh," I laughed, "yes, after I have broken all the resistance of the headwind. But I have to stay back here," he said. "I can't be up there. The family won't have it." "So you have people like Lawrence Rockefeller, who really wanted to do the right thing, but he allowed his wings to be clipped by family loyalties, and was surrounded by a mob of intelligence operatives and spooks who were hell-bent on intercepting his interests, and making sure that whatever support he could give, went into the toilet. Many wonderful things happened, including the fact that we were able to put together briefing materials which Lawrence Rockefeller used to personally brief Bill and Hillary Clinton at the ranch. You may remember that the first couple of summers of the Clinton White House, the Clintons would spend vacations at the Rockefeller Ranch. Lawrence gave the ranch to Senator Jay Rockefeller from West Virginia, but it was still the family ranch. There, they were able to discuss with Bill and Hillary Clinton the information we had assembled on the ET matter. Lawrence was sincerely trying to get this information to the right people. I later found out from a friend of the Clintons that when President Clinton returned to the White House and was reviewing the briefing documents again, he exclaimed, "And she did a perfect impersonation of Bill Clinton. I know this is all true, but goddamn it, they won't tell me a thing. Not a goddamned thing." Later I was invited to go to a meeting in New York to give a presentation at the home of a novelist named Judith Green, who had an apartment on Park Avenue. There was a large group of people present, including Mrs. Bowder as Garley, Rockefeller's representatives, a whole group of people from High New York Society were present. I spoke about contact with these life forms and what it would take to create a peaceful world here so that we could live in harmony with our extraterrestrial neighbors. My talk was very well received, and subsequently, I was able to meet with Mrs. Boutros Ghali. It was disappointing, however, that some had the misconceptions that are in rampant circulation in the mass media and UFO circles. Those who put out distorted research dealing with cattle mutilations, human vivisection, alien rapes and encounters get enormous funding from the covered group and their friends and contacts in the disinformation arm. They control and spin disinformation to the mainstream media, the UFO public, and what I call the retail consumers of all things extraterrestrial, who swallow hook, line and sinker their harvest of fear. They are very good at packaging it and seeing that only those aspects of the UFO subculture that support the party line of fear get financial support, publicity, etc. Now, unfortunately, blowing the whistle on that hasn't endeared me to some folks, but the truth is, people need to know how clever this group is at duping researchers to put out disinformation. For example, many so-called abduction researchers receive leads to abductees by being tipped off by these shadowy groups and their contacts. Often these leads are people who have been abducted in mind-control experiments that are run completely by shadowy human paramilitary operations. The information out in the public on this subject is so polluted and corrupted with disinformation and hoaxed events, that you really have to scrap it and start all over. This is not what I thought was true in 1990, but by 1993, I had heard it and seen it firsthand at the deepest and highest levels of the intelligence community. As I met firsthand with these shadowy groups and figures, this was no longer just a theory on my part, but became something I knew to be true. Unfortunately, I have had to live with a terrible burden of how much of this to say to the public. We know it will create a firestorm of hatred against us by the very machine that wants the world deceived. This huge disinformation campaign puts out enough fool's gold that the truth, the kernel of real gold, is buried under a mountain of fool's gold. And most people aren't doing an assay and wouldn't even think to do one. So everyone is accepting fool's gold and mistaking it for the real thing. Why? Because the central operation of the past 40 or 50 years has set up false decoy databases and decoy belief systems to distract people from what's actually true. This shadowy cabal forces into the civilian population completely concocted pseudo-extraterrestrial events. Very advanced technologies are used so that covert programs can simulate an extraterrestrial event, an abduction, or a cattle mutilation that looks like aliens are invading. In reality, the operation is being run out of a facility in New Mexico or Utah, using unmarked helicopters and specially trained people who swoop in and stage these hoaxed events. This is carefully calibrated psychological warfare. The stakes are enormous. The propaganda purpose is very simple: put out enough fearsome and scary information so that the operation can seed into the consciousness of the masses a back of their mind fear of anything from outer space. Eventually, the deceived masses will be brainwashed enough to support armed conflict between planets. It is all part of a preparatory or acclimation disinformation and mind control program. The public is being disinformed under the pretext of being informed. And there are willing and unwilling dupes within civilian UFO research who are part of this. Most of them are unwitting dupes. They don't even know they are being played. But who is doing this? It is not as direct as the government you learned about in civics class. What government? Which government? The shadow government, the secret government. Is the secret shadow government directly controlling these things? It's even more subtle than that. Do they have agents within the civilian UFO world? Yes.